Okay, welcome everybody. This is the eighth and final lecture in the class Money, Monopoly, and Market Intervention, our tour of Man, Economy, and State. For those of you who have been with me for the whole course, or all the courses, I should say, appreciate you sticking in there. And I guess we'll hop right into this. Also, for those who are just joining us, the WebEx software has updated a little bit, so if you have any issues, I guess just hash those out in the chat box. Okay, let's talk first a little bit about inflation. So Rothbard defines it as, quote, the process of issuing money beyond any increase in the stock of specie. So here, by specie, he means, of course, hard money like gold or silver, whatever the commodity money is. And there's a couple things here, a couple of implications. So first of all, make sure you understand what he means, that he's got in mind a fractional reserve banking system where that can increase money over and above the commodity money that's like the base money. So it's actually harder for us who use fiat money to now understand the distinction here. Because, and let me just say this in case you guys don't know this, let me just reiterate it. The distinction between 100% reserve commercial banking versus fractional reserve commercial banking is not, you know, there's that distinction, and then a different distinction is between fiat money and commodity money. All right, so those are two separate things. Now, they tend to go hand in hand, and most, you know, once the economy becomes very interventionist or the government becomes interventionist, it's a mixed, so-called mixed economy. Nowadays, you have the two, you have fiat money and fractional reserve banking, but those are different things. And so in theory, you could have, and that's exactly what guys like George Selgin and Larry White and Steve Horowitz proposed, is you had a private monetary and banking system that would be based on commodity money. So they don't like fiat money either, just like Rothbard doesn't like it. But those guys, the so-called free bankers, they're for fractional reserve banking. In other words, they don't think fractional reserve banking per se is a bad thing. They just think under central banking with the government, it distorts things and it goes to excess. But they think, with it, you know, under the discipline of the market forces, those free bankers think that fractional reserve banking in a private setting is fine, but it would be based on commodity money. All right, so the money itself could be gold, and every, you know, the prices all over could be quoted in gold ounces. And then the issue is, if you go and deposit an ounce of gold at your bank into a checking account, a demand deposit. And that term demand deposit, so I'm using those interchangeably, all right? In the banking literature, especially in the Austrian tradition, they tend to use the terms demand deposit versus a time deposit. And I think if you're totally new to this, the best analogy or analogs would be to say a demand deposit is like your checking account, whereas a time deposit is more like a savings account, or even better yet, it's like buying a CD, a certificate of deposit. Because nowadays, even your savings account is kind of like a checking account. You know, you can just switch money back and forth. And to most people, the only reason you'd have a savings account is for psychological reasons. Like, oh, when I put money in there, I forget I have it. Whereas your checking account, you know, if it's above $10, I feel like I should go to Taco Bell and buy something. Whereas, oh, it's in my savings, I can't touch it. But most people think in practice, if you know, you just go to your online banking and transfer back and forth from savings and checking. So if that's the way you're thinking about it, then don't think of it that way. Think of a time deposit as you buy a CD from the bank. So you have $1,000 that you truly want to save and invest in something in the future, and you don't want to have it's not like you want to be able to spend that money next Thursday if something comes up. You understand that you are relinquishing control over that money temporarily. You're selling present goods and buying future goods. So there, what you would do, perhaps, is you would buy a CD from the bank. And oh, I mean, the interest rates now are terrible, but let's say you buy a CD at 2%, so you give $1,000 to the bank, they give you this thing called a CD, a certificate of deposit, and you hold it for a year, and then the bank gives you $1,000, $1,020. All right, so you've earned 2% on your money. So you can see how once you do that, it's not like you go online and look and say, oh, there's my $1,000 that the bank's holding for me, and I can see it earning interest. Oh, great, there's my money. And if I need some, if I bounce a check in my checking, I can just transfer some from the CD account. No, you can't do that. That money's gone. The bank has lent it out. It's not your money anymore. What you own is not a claim to your money so much as you own this debt claim on the bank that in 1 year time they owe you $1,020. Now, if you're hard up for cash, you can try to go sell that thing on the secondary market, just like if you buy a car, that money's gone. It's not like your car is really like $10,000 that's congealed in this asset and you're driving around thinking, oh, here's my $10,000 in savings. Well, if you absolutely needed money, you could sell your car and somebody would give you money for it. All right, so, and obviously a bank CD is more liquid than a car is. So in the Austrian literature, Mises uses these terms, and then Rothbard, being a good Misesian and wanting to keep that tradition alive and that spirit of being opposed to fractional reserve banking, keeps the terms in use. So for them, it's the terminology is a demand deposit versus a time deposit. But like I say, so the what that word demand doing there, it means you can get your money on demand. And so you see how that's like a checking account, that you put it in there and you're walking around town with your checkbook or your debit card thinking the bank has my money sitting there. Now, everybody kind of knows that, well, if I'm earning interest, the bank must be lending some of it out, and everyone knows what a bank run is. So I mean, it's not like they're completely in the dark about how it works, but the point is you behave as if your money's still sitting there. You think that you have access to your money. When you go to the ATM and look at your balance and it says $842, you're thinking, I could take that out. I mean, maybe not in increments of $5, but you could take out 840. Or you could write a check for 842 and it's going to clear because you're saying, I have $842 payable on demand. That's what this account is. And so Roberts' objection then to, and in Mises as well, to fractional reserve banking is that if that's not the case, if you put $842 there, so here the fiat money is the underlying base money, the actual Federal Reserve notes, and then the commercial banks pyramid stuff on top of that. So that's an interesting distinction. I'm actually Just this lecture is unfolding in a little bit different order, but let me just not lose this train of thought. I'm sort of anticipating a future slide here in this presentation. But let me make sure you guys get that. When you're thinking of inflation and creating money out of thin air in the pejorative way that Rothbard might describe that process, it's not merely, and it's not even primarily the Federal Reserve or whatever the central bank is in your country doing it by purchasing assets. So I think we all kind of understand that when Ben Bernanke goes out and buys $1 billion worth of assets, he goes out and buys bonds issued by Fannie Mae, or when the European Central Bank buys €1 billion worth of debt issued by the Italian government, that those dollars or those euros get created out of thin air. It's a bookkeeping entry, right? They just add the assets they're purchasing to the asset side of their balance sheet, and then they write a check on it that clears by definition, or they just directly credit the electronic accounts of if they're buying it from a bank, the bank that has an account with the central bank. Okay, but under normal circumstances, so this hasn't been happening as much now during the crisis because banks aren't lending, but under normal circumstances, there's then a second round of money creation out of thin air, if you will, where the private commercial banks now, because they have more reserves caused by the central bank buying assets and open market operations and just adding more reserves to the system. Now the private commercial bank makes loans on top of that. So that's what I'm trying to get you to see is there's two things. Like I say, it's with gold, it's quite obvious. With gold, you can picture if it's 100% reserve banking, someone comes in and gives an ounce of physical yellow metal to the banker, and he goes and puts it in the vault, and then he gives the person a ticket that says the bearer of this piece of paper is entitled to, on demand, 1 ounce of gold from any branch of, you know, the Smith Bank. In the Mestesian terminology, that thing is a money certificate because it's backed up by the ounce of gold. But now what happens, so now let's say, you know, you deposit 100 ounces of gold, or a bunch of customers collectively deposit 100 ounces of gold, and they each got the receipt. If that's all the banker did, that would be 100% reserve banking. That wouldn't change the money supply. That, you know, all it would have done is change the composition of it. That now the community still thinks they have the same amount of total money measured in terms of gold ounces. It's just instead of them walking around with 100 ounces of the metal, they walk around with these money certificates. And so you can do it either way. You can just count the metal, or you can count the money certificates, but then you don't count the metal that's in the vault, because that'd be double counting. So, you know, the community still collectively has the same amount of money. You know, if you're using M1 or M2 or something, well, M1. So, but with fractional reserve banking now, depositors put in 100 ounces of gold, 100 ounces of yellow metal sitting in the vault. There have now been issued 100 ounces of paper claim tickets. And now the bankers say, you know what, though, in practice, these guys aren't going to all show up at the same day. We're going to lend out another 10 ounces of gold. And they can either take it from the vault and literally hand the 10 ounces to somebody, and then, you know, write down, say, okay, you owe us, whatever, 11 ounces in 12 months to charge the person 10% rate of interest. Or they don't even need to do that. They can just print up another 10 of those pieces of paper that say the bearer of this note is entitled upon demand to get 1 ounce of gold from Smith Bank, and they give out 10 more of those things to a borrower. And why would the borrower sign his name on a promissory note saying I owe Smith Bank 11 ounces of gold next year in exchange for these pieces of paper? Because the community accepts them. Smith Bank's been around for a while. They've never reneged on their promise. Anytime someone shows up at one of their counters with those pieces of paper, they get an ounce of physical gold. So the community trusts it. And so that's how Smith Bank can get away with so-called creating money out of thin air. So that's the sense in which the commercial banks do it. So you can see, what do we mean if we want to say, oh, they just created 10 ounces of gold out of thin air. It's not that they created 10 more physical pieces of yellow metal. It's obviously those claim tickets are now, you know, that's what we're including. So that would be included like an M1, if you know those definitions. So M1 really did just go up by 10 ounces of gold because the bank engaged in fractional reserve banking. So if you can picture it with gold versus paper tickets issued by the bank, which would be bank notes, now it's a little bit trickier to see the distinction with our current system, where commercial banks are legally prohibited from issuing bank notes. The central bank in the United States, and I think most other countries as well, has a monopoly on the issue of bank notes. But so Citibank can't issue pieces of paper that you put in your wallet that are, you know, generic, transferable claims on Citibank that upon demand, I get $100 at any branch of Citibank. You know what I'm saying? Like that's really not something you would have. You have a, what are they called? Is it a money certificate? I'm blanking out here. Like a money order. You have those things, but they're not really money. You know what I mean? They're an order. You see what I'm saying? Like they don't circulate the way Federal Reserve notes circulate. Whereas a long time ago, before central banks monopolized it, people would in the community, the banknotes, notes, pieces of paper issued by private commercial banks would circulate as a medium of exchange among certain circles. So, anyway, back to the point, there is a distinction in terms of the inflation that, yes, when Bernanke buys assets and creates $1 billion out of thin air, that's one aspect of it. But then also, if a regular commercial bank just gives somebody a mortgage and part of it is not backed up by dollar bills that are in the vault or on deposit with the Fed, then that's also money. So the distinction there is when you go, how can I put it? So yes, a $20 bill issued by the Federal Reserve, a $20, got the picture of Andrew Jackson on it, that's fiat money. You say, oh, it's not backed up by anything. But what's even less real or of substance is if you go to the ATM and look at your balance and it says you have $842 on deposit, because you don't. You've only got, the bank only has, whatever, $85 sitting somewhere that's backing up that $842 that the ATM says you have on deposit. I'm speaking generally. Actually, now with the crisis, I think the banks actually have more than 100% reserves, but you get what I'm saying in general under fractional reserve banking. So the point is, it's like a double whammy that not only do we have this fiat money, which isn't a real commodity, but the bank's pyramid loans on top of that. So just make sure you get that distinction. So the big point of all this is I'm trying to drive home is the Misesian theory of the business cycle is not about how the central bank causes the boom-bust cycle. It's actually more accurately about how the creation of money and credit through fractional reserve banking causes the business cycle. Okay, but back to this first slide here. So Rothbard defines inflation as the process of issuing money beyond any increase in the stock of specie. So what he's saying is it's, one implication is that it means business cycles on the free market with 100% reserves are impossible. So Rothbard thinks that fractional reserve banking is fraudulent. Therefore, for Rothbard, on a free market where property rights are respected and there's no fraud, banks have to abide by 100% reserve banking. And since under that framework, you couldn't issue more money beyond any increase in the stock of gold or silver or whatever the commodity money is, therefore inflation is impossible. And since Rothbard thinks inflation is necessary for the Austrian business cycle, then see what I'm saying? An Austrian business cycle can't happen on the genuinely free market. All right. So I don't know if Rothbard ever spelled it out in one sentence the way I'm doing here, but that's certainly implied by his framework and everything. So I'm just saying I think he chose this definition knowing that that was one of the implications, and he liked that implication, that if you define inflation like this, then you can't have an Austrian business cycle. And he does say something in one of the footnotes. I mean, I'm not going out on a limb here. I mean, he does say something. It's actually tied to this definition, if you didn't catch it. When he defines it this way early on in the section that we're covering, he's got a footnote saying specifically, so if miners discover a bunch of gold, I'm not calling that inflation. He said, yes, it does have some consequences are similar, like prices in general quoted in gold ounces will go up, but he said it will not cause the boom-bust cycle the way credit expansion does. Just as an interesting tidbit, Mises doesn't define inflation that way. And this is one of the issues if you're, on this whole issue of fractional reserve banking, this is one of the points of contention. So I'm not going to take sides here because, first of all, it's a black hole and we'll get sucked into it and no one will ever hear from us again. But also, what's the point of me taking sides on this for a general class? But just so you know, in the theory of money and credit, Mises is talking about inflation and deflation, and then he says, in terms of economic theory, if you're going to define them, the only definitions that, I forget the way he put it, but I think what he's saying is, the only way to give a coherent definition that's not going to lead you into contradictions or cause problems with other areas of economic theory is if you define inflation as an increase in the quantity of money above an increase in the demand to hold money. So there, you know, Mises is admitting that if there were a huge gold discovery that didn't coincide exactly with growth in population or growth in the economy or international trade and more people wanting to hold money, then Mises would call that inflation. All right, but what I'm not as sure about, and I think it's, Mises actually is a little bit, I don't want to say contradictory, but let me just put it to you this way. A while back, Joe Salerno and who was it? Maybe Selgin, but I'm not sure. But anyway, those guys kind of got in a little tiff about, you know, where does Mises fit into this whole fractional reserve banking thing? And the problem is, if you want, you can dig up quotes from the theory of money and credit that seem to airtight say, anytime there is an expansion, you know, anytime there's an issuance of fiduciary media, which is Mises' term for unbacked, when banks make loans, they're not backed up by commodity money, so it's fractional reserve banking. There's passages where Mises says, anytime you do that, it sets up a boom-bust cycle. So if you read those passages, it looks like, you know, and Salerno's dug them up to bolster his case that, come on, guys, you so-called free bankers, you are allowing for the boom-bust cycle. But then there's other parts where if you use Mises' definition here of inflation, then it's not as clear. Or you could argue even under 100% reserve banking, you could have the boom-bust cycle, right? So I'm just – and the problem, like I say, is I think Mises it doesn't quite fit. Like, in other words, he's – it's not even that he's being ambiguous, it's he's kind of being clear in one spot and clear in the other spot, and the two don't seem to mesh. And so it's hard to, there's not an outright contradiction where he says over here A is one thing and over here A is something else, but if you take the implications of what he's saying in one spot versus the other, they don't fit together. And so that's the problem with in the modern day fractional reserve banking debate, trying to see which side would Mises come down on. They can both go back to theory of money and credit and find textual support. So that's the problem. Okay. So this next slide that I've titled Inflation by the Banks, I think I covered most of this already, but let me just stress two points. How is it that a commercial bank, what's in it for them when they so-called create money out of thin air? It's, I mean, you say, well, duh. Who wouldn't want to be able to create money out of thin air? But just be careful. It's not that they just create the money and pocket it. It's not that the bankers say, hey, let's issue a dividend to our shareholders this month, and let's just print it up. Rather, they issue money out of thin air to make loans, and then they earn interest on them. So if you just go back to the example I was working with a couple minutes ago, and switch back to thinking of gold, because I think that's the easiest way to think of it to get these concepts straight, since the difference between fiat money that's in the vault versus a fractional reserve checking account balance that's a claim on fiat money, it gets, that distinction's kind of odd. But think of it in terms of the community uses a commodity money like gold, but yet they have fractional reserve banking. So there's depositors come in, they put 100 ounces of gold in the vault. The agents of Smith Bank issue 100 of those pieces of paper, claim tickets. Those people go out, they still think they got their money now in the bank. So they have those pieces of paper in their wallets. They go to the store, they want to buy something that costs 1 ounce of gold, they just pull out one of those tickets and give it to the merchant, and the merchant puts it in the drawer and they walk out with the merchandise. Now, so how does Smith Bank benefit financially from engaging in fractional reserve banking? Because now, like I say, over time they notice that the 100 ounces of gold is sitting there. Occasionally someone will come in, put down some of those pieces of paper and say, "Give me the physical gold," and I got to open up the vault and give it to them. But generally the physical stuff gets redeposited some later date, and they never go lower than 75 on a typical month or something. You know, it never breaches that level. So they figure if we just kept even 10, we'd be all right. But anyway, let's say they're very conservative, so they just lend out 10 of it, so they're keeping 90 still in the vault. So again, it would be reckless. They couldn't just take 10 ounces out of the vault and go buy something with it. Go buy a car that costs 10 ounces of gold. That would be reckless because now they're just permanently, that's just gone. And I mean, they could maybe try it a few times, and then they would have to stop and say, "That's it. Gravy train's over, because we can't go much lower. Otherwise, at some point, we're going to get caught when people show up, and we're not going to have enough in the vault to pay them back." So rather than doing these one-shot sort of embezzlements, instead what they can do is, let's say they take out 10 ounces of gold and they lend it to somebody at a 10% interest rate. So that today they give someone 10 ounces of gold out of the vault, or they leave it in the vault and print up 10 more tickets, doesn't matter which way they do it, and say, "Okay, you sign a contract with us. We're giving you 10 ounces of gold today. A year from now, you're going to give us back 11 ounces of gold." The person signs the contract. All right. So assuming the person doesn't default, the way the bank benefits from that is because a year later, when the person comes back with 11 ounces of gold, the people at Smith Bank take it, they cancel the IOU that guy signed from the mortgage or the personal promissory note, whatever it was. So now that guy's off the hook. He paid his loan back to the bank. They take 10 of those ounces and they put it back in the vault. Or if it were just tickets and the guy's paying them with tickets, they could just, burn 10 of them. And now that last ounce is theirs free and clear. So if it's a physical, hunk of metal, obviously that's theirs. They already put the 10 back in the vault. So the vault's back to where it was. The customers who made the 100 ounces originally, that deposit, they're all whole now. If they all show up at the same time, the bank's fine. They got it all back in the vault. But that 11th ounce, the person paid in interest, is now the bank's free and clear. So if it's a piece of yellow metal, it's obvious. But even if it's one of their tickets, well, that ticket is now backed up by gold in the vault. See what I'm saying? So the person who took the loan out, as long as he didn't default, if he was able over the course of a year to turn that 10 ounces of the loan into a total of 11 ounces, with which he could then pay off the loan, in his dealings with the community, on net, he extracted 1 ounce of gold from them, either physically, the metal, or with those tickets. And so once we extinguished that 10 ounces that was fiduciary media, inflationary, that remaining 1 ounce of gold that was an interest payment was part of the original money stock that is backed up by gold. It's either a physical bar itself or coin, or it's a claim ticket that's 100% reserve backed up by the vault. And so what that means is somebody in the community that originally deposited an ounce of gold and got a ticket, over the course of that year in his dealings with that guy who then took out a loan, gave that ticket to the guy. I mean, maybe he lost it playing cards, or maybe the guy performed a service, whatever, it doesn't matter. One of those tickets ended up in the hands of the guy who was then paying the bank back with the interest. Okay, so that's how fractional reserve banking can be a perpetual source of income for the bankers. If they lend out excess money and earn interest on it, and then that interest is not inflation. It's the principal that's inflated, if you will. I don't know if that helps you to think about it. And so notice too, the banks create and destroy money. So in that example, they create 10 ounces of gold out of thin air when they lend it to somebody. Then that person, in his dealings with the community, turns that 10 into 11. Now, of course, I'm speaking metaphorically. The person doesn't really turn 10 into 11. What I mean is, on net, he earns 1 ounce of gold somehow. I mean, he probably earns more. since he doesn't want to just break even if he has a successful business. But if he's able to pay back the loan, he earned at least 1 ounce of gold on net. And then he pays the 11 back to the bank, and then, like I say, whether he pays it in, if he pays it in gold, like the actual metal, by putting that back in the vault, that has extinguished 10 ounces of gold from the community, because before, there was a person out there who had the claim tickets from that those 10 ounces, and then on top of that, the bank took the 10 ounces out of the vault and gave it to somebody else. So now you had the tickets running around and the metal running around that those tickets allegedly were pointing to. So that was the way in which the community's stockpile of money went up by 10. So now when you take those 10 ounces of gold and put them back in the vault, the amount of money the community goes back to what it was. Or if they kept 100 ounces in the vault the whole time and just issued 10 more pieces of paper, then when the person pays it back, the bank can just throw them out, or can put them in a drawer, and they're not really money anymore. So just make sure you see that the bank creates money and destroys it by advancing a loan and then letting the loan get paid off. Now, of course, normally they're just going to keep rolling it over, but that's kind of an important point, and it also kind of helps tie into why fractional reserve banking is more intimately tied to the Austrian business cycle than just gold discoveries are. Because, I mean, there's other things you could bring up too, other differences. But one important difference is, even if we go out and find a bunch of new gold and that comes into the economy, and even if for some reason it came in primarily through the credit markets, because that's another difference too. If someone goes and finds a bunch of gold, he's probably going to spend a lot of it on consumption. It's not like he's going to invest 100% of it. And so it's going to have Cantillon effects and push up prices and do this and that and the other, but it's not going to come in first all through the credit market and really push down the rate of interest. It would depend on the gold miners who bring in all the new gold. It would depend on how much they save of it. So with fractional reserve banking through the commercial banking system, inflation through the commercial banking system, all of that money, the very first way it enters the economy is via a loan. So the first price that it screws up is interest rates. Okay, but anyway, finish that train of thought. Another difference between just general gold discoveries versus inflation via fractional reserve banking is, okay, let's say they find 10% more gold. Well, it's not like once prices start rising and then the gold miners get nervous and they destroy those 10 ounces of gold or that 10% of gold. Whereas with the banks, it is like that. That when the boom is going on, they keep expanding credit, everything looks great, but then prices start rising, the central bank starts tightening, people start failing, the banks then tighten up, and the supply of credit contracts. That's, I mean, especially back like in the classical days, like in the 19th century, the sort of standard business cycle that Mises was studying to then try to explain theoretically. I mean, that's partly why you had actual massive price deflation during the bust period, was because the money supply actually contracted. Whereas nowadays, that doesn't happen as much. It's just the inflation slows during a bust, but it doesn't actually go negative. So that's another difference when you're trying to, the standard classical Austrian business cycle theory, the way it plays out is the commercial banks expand the supply of money, and then they contract it. So you can see why that would really screw everything up. Whereas some guys, hit the mother load and a bunch of new gold comes in, okay, that might have a one-shot distortionary effect, but then it's not like that gold is going to then contract once the corner turns on the economy. Okay, another point here, Incidentally, all this stuff that I'm talking about, fraction reserve banking and central banking and fiat versus commodity money, if this stuff interests you, then by all means, take the next class I'm going to offer, which is going to be in January. We haven't picked a date yet, where we're going to go through the Mises theory of money and credit. I mean, so there, we'll really go through this stuff, and you'll, you know, I'll have numerical examples and everything, and we'll work with bank balance sheets if you really want to understand this. But in lieu of that, let me just give you the quickie explanation here. So this stuff is really neat to think through what would a free market in banking look like. So here, the point is, so you don't get lost if you're listening to me online or after the fact, I'm on the slide saying inflation by banks, and I'm on the last point here, that central banks break down the market's natural barriers to low reserve banking. So what we can do is say, we already know that Rothbard thinks fraction reserve banking per se is fraudulent, wouldn't happen on a free market. Somebody could bring a suit against a commercial bank that was engaging in fraction reserve banking, I think in Rothbard's view, and say, hey, that's fraud. But suppose we had a, you know, an otherwise free market, but you had fraction reserve banking. So in other words, the people next to the judges didn't think it was fraud, and so it was allowed to go on. What market forces would come in and limit it? And so here, the idea is, picture different, so each bank has its own clientele, and you've got banknotes that are being issued. So there's, you know, Citibank has pieces of paper, a Citibank note that maybe says the bearer of this gets 1 ounce of gold as it's presented to any Citibank branch. And you know, and it's clear, it's got logos and stuff, and it's hard to counterfeit, and it really, it's issued by Citibank. You know, they have teams of artists and other people to make sure it's hard to reproduce. Maybe someone can't just put it in a color copier. And then other banks have the same thing. You know, Fifth Third Bank has its own banknotes, so on. So if you're buying something, so what do you, as a customer of Citibank, why would you want to have those notes? What's the convenience factor? You don't want to lug around a bunch of physical gold, because it's, first of all, it's heavy. Second of all, if you're going to go make a big purchase, you don't, you know, it's, you'd be a target. You'd be, you know, you don't want to walk around with that kind of money in terms of physical gold and so on. So that's one reason you might do it. So, or even the other way, like for smaller amounts, that sort of solves the problem of what if the money, what if the commodity money gets to be so scarce that its purchasing power is too high? Well, it's easy to, like, but let's say, you know, 1 ounce of gold buys 10 mansions, and people say, oh, so, you know, how would it work? Well, you could just have all the gold physically on deposit with the bank, and they could issue paper notes that say the bearer of this is entitled to, you know, 1/1000th of a gram of gold. Okay, so, I mean, that's not historically how it played out, but I'm just saying that's one reason, too, that issuing paper notes that were backed up by the physical thing, that why that might be a benefit. Okay, so back to the main story here. We already said why the customers would hold those things. Now, the merchants in the community are going to accept them also at par with yellow metal. So something is quoted, you go into a store and the thing says this costs 2 ounces of gold. You could either give coins to the merchant that are physical ounces of gold, you know, they're made by a private mint and they're stamped and everything, and they got the, what do you call those, around the circumference, they're, you know, chipped. I'm blanking out here. But so you can't clip the edges. Yeah, there's grooves around there. So, you know, they have that kind of stuff. So that all these things are all provided by the private market. So you have the physical coins, or you give them a banknote, and the reason the merchant takes it at par, it's not like he says, oh, you got to give me 2.3 paper notes or just give me 2 physical coins. No, he'll accept the banknote at par because in practice, Citibank is always good. There's never been a case where somebody showed up at Citibank, handed them the you know, pay the bearer on demand, and they said, sorry, we don't have the gold on hand right now. So that's, you know, that's a crucial, necessary component to all this stuff, is that the banks in practice have to pay on demand. Otherwise, people lose confidence and the bank goes under. Okay. So the merchants accept it all at par, but here's the thing. If you're a merchant and you accept banknotes from your own bank, you might just keep them in your drawer. Right? So if the merchant himself is a client of Citibank, and a customer comes in and buys something that costs 2 ounces of gold and gives two Citibank banknotes for ounces of gold to the guy, he might just leave it in his drawer and then, you know, put it in his safe or whatever, because in his normal operations, even himself, when he's walking around town spending money on stuff, in his wallet, he's got banknotes issued by Citibank because he's one of their customers. So from his point of view, a banknote issued by Citibank really is interchangeable with yellow metal. In fact, in some scenarios, it's superior. Okay, but what if a rival bank issues a banknote? So a customer comes in who banks with Fifth Third, let's say, and gives the merchant a note issued by Fifth Third. Now, so this is the thing where advocates of central banking think a free market breaks down. They think, oh, there'd be anarchy here. You know, people would have to keep tabs on all the different notes that are issued, and there'd be fly-by-night companies. And no, there wouldn't. As long as somebody presented a note by a reputable bank and the merchant, you know, would know, yeah, I've never heard an issue of Fifth Third not paying people, he would go ahead and sell to them at par also. And so now you say, okay, well, then why wouldn't Fifth Third or Citibank, if the people in the community are trading their notes freely, and even clients of other banks accept the notes issued by rival banks at par, why wouldn't they all just inflate like crazy? Well, because here's what happens. The merchant now, who's a client of Citibank, you can see how he might just sit on notes issued by Citibank that his own customers pay him. But if a customer comes in and buys something that costs 2 ounces of gold and gives him Fifth Third banknotes, what he's not going to sit on that because he's not a member of Fifth Third, right? He deals with Citibank. If he ever needs to turn in money, you know, turn the notes into gold, he would rather just have all Citibank notes because that's the, you know, that's where his own personal account is, his business account, alliance, you know, his checking account. So he's not going to want to have to make a separate trip out to Fifth Third and present it there. So what he's going to do is, you know, at the end of the week or something, when he deposits his money, he's going to take all of his bank notes and go deposit them with his bank, let's say. Or even maybe he does it every day. Who knows, depending on the nature of his business. So at some point, anytime a member, a client of a rival bank shops with this merchant and pays with banknotes issued by the rival bank, eventually those notes are going to end up, he's going to go to his own bank, Citibank, and deposit them into his account. And Citibank, too, is going to honor them at par. So let's say originally he has 1,000 ounces of gold on deposit in his checking account with Citibank, and he comes in and makes a deposit and says, yep, I had a good week. Here's all, you know, a bunch of banknotes, some actual gold coins, and then also some banknotes issued by Fifth Third, and they're all going to get counted at par. And he's going to look at his bank balance. If he's got an ATM card, look at it. It's going to go up by the exact number that he thought. There's going to be no distinction made between notes issued by Citibank, notes issued by Fifth Third, or actual gold coins. But now consider Citibank. So it's got all his deposits coming in, and some of these are notes issued by its rival. What's Citibank going to do? For sure, Citibank is going to settle up with Fifth Third. Maybe they do it every week. Maybe they do it every month. But at some point, they're going to coordinate with each other, and Citibank's going to say, okay, over the course of this last month, we've accumulated 100,000 banknotes that are, you know, demand claims on you, saying the bearer of this gets 1 ounce of gold from you. We've got 100,000 of those things that we accumulated this month from our customers depositing them. And then Fifth Third is going to say, oh, well, we have 97,000 banknotes issued by you guys that our customers have deposited into their checking accounts with us. So then they're going to say, okay, we'll cancel out the 97,000, and then, how's it work? Fifth Third owes Citibank 3,000 ounces of gold to settle up. And then Citibank is not going to say, oh, don't worry about it, you're good for it, because they're, you know, they're competitors. Citibank's going to say, okay, give us the 3,000 ounces, which they have every legal right to do. They've got pieces of paper saying the bearer of this on demand can get an ounce of gold, and they've got 3,000 of those net. So they hand them over to Fifth Third, and Fifth Third has to go in at the vault and pull out 3,000 ounces of gold, and then they go and put that in the vault of Citibank. Because, you know, since gold is the actual commodity money, of course, the banks, to be in a stronger position, are going to want to have gold in their vaults rather than pieces of paper issued by a competitor. Okay, so if you're still with me so far, now you can see why. So that's the system known as free banking. That's what people mean by free banking, or at least people in the Austrian tradition. So that sort of system, Citibank and Fifth Third, they're allowed to engage in fractional reserve banking. That's perfectly legal. But they better not ever get caught with their pants down, or they're going to go out of business. So if they're still in business, it's only because in practice they've always been able to redeem those banknotes when people show up. Because if they didn't, and here's the thing, even if you might say, well, what if they build into the contract that we'll do our best to make this thing redeemable for money upon demand, you know, instantly convertible into gold, but, you know, let's be frank here, we're engaging in fractional reserve banking, you're earning a small interest rate on your checking account, you know, we don't just have the money sitting with your name out of the vault, we're lending it out to people. So on the off chance that everybody shows up next Tuesday at 10 a.m. and wants his money back, we have the contractual right to tell you to come back in 30 days. So they could do that, and that's, you know, part of the way that libertarians who are okay with fractional reserve banking try to say it could exist legally and not be fraud. And, you know, I don't want to argue about that, but okay, let's assume that's right. Still, economically, now, if the community harbors any doubt about the instant redeemability of those banknotes into gold, they're not going to trade at par, because now those are different things. And so a merchant, you know, let's say that Fifth Third, three times in the past year, has told its customers they had to wait up to 30 days before they could turn those banknotes into gold coins. They might not have been breaking any contracts, you know, maybe that was spelled out crystal clear in the contracts when people open up checking accounts with them, but now merchants are not going to just freely accept gold coins, notes issued by Citibank or notes issued by Fifth Third. They're going to say, no, if you want to pay me with Fifth Third banknotes, I'm going to ding you, you know, a 5% premium or penalty, I should say. So something that costs 100 ounces of gold, if you pay in gold coins or with Citibank notes, I'm going to charge you 105 if you pay me with Fifth Third notes, because, you know, those are different things to me as a merchant. I might get stuck sitting on these Fifth Third notes for a month, whereas I'd rather have the actual gold. So then if that's the process, then who the heck is going to be a customer of Fifth Third if they know that they got to, you know, pay more for everything because they're using Fifth Third notes? So you see, the only way this really works is if the community is generally thinking day-to-day transactions is never going to be an issue. These things are always going to be instantly redeemable. Okay, we're almost here. Hang in with me. So so now you see why, given this free banking system, Fifth Third cannot inflate at a much greater rate than Citibank does. Because if they do, what does that mean? That means Fifth Third, let's say originally they both have 95% reserves, right? So they originally, you know, for every 100 ounces of gold that they have on deposit in the vault, they each issue, or they take 5 of those ounces and lend them out, or they issue 5 more paper tickets. It doesn't matter what the respective sizes are, because you could say, well, one bank's a lot bigger than the other, right? But then statistically, the way their customers interact with each other, you know, the net accumulation in each respective bank of notes issued by the other party is going to balance out, right? So a Fifth Third's a real dinky bank and only has a few customers, then it hasn't printed up many of those notes, but then on the same token, those customers aren't going to interact that much with the customers of Citibank, right? You get what I'm saying? So the issue is what fraction is, what the fraction of other notes that are backed or not. So now, so they reach an equilibrium. Originally, they each have 95% reserve ratio, and they reach an equilibrium. Yeah, some months on net gold flows out of the vault from Citibank to Fifth Third or vice versa. But over the course of a year, it basically cancels out. So, but now Fifth Third's like, you know what, this fractional reserve banking is pretty sweet. Why don't we just go down to a 5% reserve ratio? So now, for every 100 ounces of gold that we have on deposit, there are people out there with checking accounts that put that metal in there, we're not just going to lend out an extra 5 ounces, we're going to print up 95 tickets and lend those things out, because now we'll earn that much more interest because we're making so many more loans. Well, they could do that for a while, but then what's going to happen is now their clients have a lot more banknotes because they made all those new loans. And so now they're, in terms of, they're going out in the community and spending on average in the months after that decision, or even the weeks, merchants and other people are going to be depositing with Citibank a lot more Fifth Third banknotes than Fifth Third customers are going to be depositing with Fifth Third banknotes issued by Citibank, because Citibank hasn't printed up a bunch of notes, whereas Fifth Third all of a sudden disturbed the equilibrium by printing up a ton more notes that are now floating around and being spent. So now when they go to settle up at the end of the month, Citibank is going to have a lot more net notes issued by Fifth Third, and so give us the gold. So you can see if Fifth Third tries to expand too quickly, they're going to quickly have their gold reserves drained to their competitor banks. So that's why in a system of free banking, even if it's legal, if fractional reserve banking is legal, market forces are going to limit what that reserve ratio is. Now, we don't know in practice what it's going to be. I think, you know, there have been the Austrians in the free banking literature are aware of everything I just said, and they argue market forces might make it fairly low, the reserve ratio. I kind of think it would be pretty high, but, you know, that's an empirical question. Because so what I've just established to you, I haven't just shown you that banks can't have low reserve ratios. What I just proved to you is one bank can't have a much lower ratio than all the other banks. But what could happen is the banks could all form an agreement and say, let's all inflate together. So what if we, in a coordinated fashion, reduced our reserve ratios from 95% down to 5%, then that might work. Because now you don't have this problem of reserves getting drained from the inflating bank, because they all offset each other. So the problem there is, just as with any cartel, what would stop some rival from starting up a new bank that has, you know, a 10% reserve ratio, and then over time he's going to be skimming gold out of the vaults of all the other banks. So the trade-off here, in case you're wondering, like, well, gee, so doesn't that logic lead you automatically to say a market equilibrium could only exist at 100% reserves? Not necessarily, because remember, the banks earn more income, interest income, through fractional reserve banking. So it's, whereas, right, so if you have, an initial equilibrium, and all the banks had an agreement with each other, and they all had 5% reserve ratios. It's true, if some rival started up with a 10% reserve ratio, he would slowly accumulate all the gold in the vaults of the other guys, but that doesn't mean he'd be having a profitable business, because he'd have to charge a higher interest rate on his loans than they do, or he couldn't pay as much interest on his checking accounts as they could. And so it's not clear that he'd actually would be profitable in doing that. You see what I'm saying? So the business of banking is not to just accumulate a bunch of gold in the vault that's not yours, that your customer's gold, because that's what would be happening. It's not, let me make sure you guys get that point. When I say someone coming in and forming a bank that earns 10 or that has a 10% reserve ratio would start accumulating all the gold of the competitors, that gold that the 10% bank is getting in the vault, that's not like the bank owners to go spend. Remember, that it just means that's gold backing up the deposits of that bank's own customers. So it's an asset of the bank, but it's not profit. That's what I'm getting at. That accumulation of gold is not, you're not saying, oh, yep, that's showing all the profit that bank has made. The bank might even be losing money in a income statement. It's just because over time, because remember, how does the gold get in there? Because the more conservative bank that has a 10% reserve ratio, it's not printing up as many notes. So in general, the customers of the other banks are buying more stuff from the conservative bank's customers than vice versa, because the reckless bank's customers have a lot more banknotes. So then the customers of the conservative bank go and deposit those rival bank's notes into their own checking account. And then the conservative bank credits their account, you know, makes the number go. So if someone gives it 10 notes of 1 ounce gold claims issued by Fifth Third, and the conservative bank, we'll call it Rothbard Bank, well, no, because it's called Lockman Bank, credits their accounts by 10 ounces. So that person's checking account went up, and now Lockman Bank, at the end of the month, has on net 10 ounces issued by Fifth Third, that, you know, and Fifth Third doesn't have notes issued by Lockman Bank, so they say, give us the gold. So, oh, I've got 10 ounces of gold, but that's not the owners of Lockman, that's not Lockman's to do with what he wants. He just puts it in the vault to be backing up what his customer deposited. Now, he can lend out 9 of it if he keeps a 10% reserve, so I mean, it's better than not doing it, but my point is it's not just automatic that the banks would keep one-upping each other. You know, there could be an equilibrium at which it doesn't make sense for some newcomer to enter the banking industry, even though the existing reserve ratio is not 100%. So you could tweak the assumptions on that, and like I say, I personally think market forces would push it up toward 100%, but it depends on the assumptions you make. Okay, let's move on. Austrian business cycle theory. Well, that's a big topic. Again, if you like this stuff, we're going to cover this in much greater detail in the next big class that we'll do for the Academy. But here, let me just give you a quick summary of it. So I think the best way to understand Austrian business cycle theory is to understand what genuine sustainable economic growth is in the Austrian view. And then it's pretty simple to figure out, well, how does that get screwed up? So if you took the course with me when we went over those diagrams with the capital structure and how there's savings and how what that does, I mean, this will be child's play to you. That's why I spent so much time on that stuff. Okay, so for the Austrians, prices act as signals. I think we all know that. I'm not going to belabor the point. Incidentally, what this middle part is, I have when I go on the road and speak to a general audience who don't even know what Austrian economics is, these slides that you're about to see are what I try to do to get the basic idea across. So since I like this PowerPoint, that's why I'm using it with you guys. This is probably actually a little bit too sophomoric for you guys. So the interest rates are special prices that coordinate through time. And so here, I mean, this is a sort of goofy thing, but so you got this family over here. They consume a lot of their income, spend it on the restaurant, other things, TVs, whatever, and they save some of it. They put it in the bank, and then the bank lends it out to some factory, and the interest rate's 10%. So now what happens if the family decides to save more? So notice I moved one of the dollar signs from up here down here, or two of the dollar signs, I guess. So if the family saves more, what are they doing? They're spending less, they're consuming less, the restaurant's getting less, and the bank now is getting more. And so what happens? The interest rate drops. Let's say it goes from 10 to 5%. And now, because of the lower interest rate, the factory borrows more, right? So what's happened is, ultimately, the purchasing power, because of the family's decision to save more, has been transferred away from the consumption sector into the investment sector, or the capital goods sector, or the higher order stages. So it's not just about the dollars. There's a physical change that goes on in the economy. So the first period, what I'm showing here is that resources, whether it's workers or minerals, you know, natural resources, that's I think iron ore, go out of away from the restaurants and towards the factory. And then the next period, what happens? Well, now because the factory is getting more real resources, they create more stuff, more hammers and other types of equipment, capital goods. And so then what does that mean? Now the workers, aided with more capital goods, can create more consumption goods. Right? So this is consistent with that more elaborate story that Rofford went through in the earlier chapters about saving and investment and capital accumulation. That you see how in the short term here, initially, the restaurant really has to lay off workers, right? So these workers, the only way you can get more people producing capital goods is if you get fewer people producing consumption goods, at least, you know, barring a technological development. We're just talking about the impact of people saving more. So the economy rebalances itself. It's not an issue of total production or total employment or even total spending. It's just an issue of what avenues do the spending or production fall under or go down. So instead of the economy cranking out consumption goods like restaurant meals and blockbuster movies and plasma screen TVs and sports cars, instead the economy shifts to producing tools, you know, drill presses, concrete, bricks, telescopes, stuff like that, ball bearings, hammers and nails, and tractor trailers. So things that are not directly useful, that don't, you know, directly confer utility in terms of consumption, but they're indirectly useful. Okay, so then I say, well, what if, you know, what was the mechanism there? It was that when the family saved more, that pushed down interest rates. So in a sense, you know, economically, that was a signal that savings were less scarce. And so that's why the factory was able to borrow more. And business people in general can engage in longer-term projects at a lower interest rate. So a lot of times if I'm giving a talk to like small business owners, I can use an example like this because they get present discounted value. I know there's a lot of adults who take these classes, so let me use this example if it resonates with you. If not, you know, I won't take too long. But let's say you're thinking about, you know, you're a developer and you're thinking about buying a parcel of land downtown and building a five-story apartment complex. So you're running the numbers to see if it makes sense to do that. and you figure it'll cost you $1 million up front, to get the land and to build it, to pay the workers and everything to build this thing. And then from that point on, you figure you can rent out the various units, and on average, over the course of a year, you're going to net $100,000 in income. Right? The rent that the tenants pay you to stay in your units of this building over and above your operating costs, you figure you're going to clear $100,000 of net income each year from that. So do you want to do it? And the answer is you need to know what the interest rate is. Because if the going interest rate on very safe bonds is 20%, well, then you'd be silly to take $1 million and pump it into a project that's only going to yield you $100,000 year after year. Because then you're only earning 10% on your money. You'd be better off just taking that $1 million and buying those bonds that yield 20% year after year. On the other hand, if the interest rate in general is 2 or 3%, well, then this project looks really lucrative. And you'd probably do it, assuming that you were confident in your estimates and you didn't, think that the demand to stay in apartments was going to collapse 5 years out, where you didn't think they were going to come in and impose rent control, that kind of stuff. If you were pretty sure you'd be able to earn $100,000 perpetually, you would go ahead and do that if the interest rate were 2 or 3%. So notice what happened there. The higher the interest rate, the less likely you would be to start that very long-term project, to, build this whole thing so that you could then rent it out into the foreseeable future. But as the interest rate goes down, you become more and more likely to do it. Whereas if you're trying to decide, do I want to, I don't know. It's going to be really hot next week, and there's a golf tournament that's going to happen. Do I want to set up a hot dog stand and sell lemonade there over the course of the long 3-day weekend, where there's going to be thousands of tourists here to watch the golf tournament, and the forecast says it's going to be pretty hot. Do I want to, put up, it's probably going to cost me, whatever, $1,000 to get the cart. Maybe I got to get a permit to be able to stay there, and I got to buy all the raw hot dogs, I got to buy all the hamburger buns, all the ketchup and everything, and then I got to sit there for 3 days and sell the hot dogs and sit there and smile at people and whatever. Is that worth it to me? And so you're running the numbers thinking, well, what if I sold this many? What do I think that, what if it rains? But what you're not going to worry about is what's the interest rate. Whether the interest rate's 2% or 20%, it doesn't really matter because you're going to turn that money over really quickly, especially if you assume that you would sell the hot dog cart on eBay after the tournament's over. See what I'm saying? You're just thinking, I might have to put in $1,000 up front, and then 3 days later, I might have $5,000 to show for it. And so is my labor worth that $4,000 plus, the risk I'm taking? Right? So it doesn't matter what the interest rate is because your money's not going to be tied up for that long. Whereas with the apartment complex, your money's going to be tied up for decades. Once you build that building, you're going to want to, earn that return. And you can't even say, oh, but I could just sell the apartment building. No, because if interest rates are really low and you sell, you sell, or sorry, if interest rates are really high, got mixed up there, and you spend $1 million building this thing, you can't go and sell it for $1 million, right? If the interest rates are 10%, it would work. You'd just break even. But if interest rates are 20%, how much would someone pay you for that building? They say, well, you earn $100,000 a year, so at a 20% interest rate, I would be willing to pay you $500,000 for that thing. Right? So then you would have just lost half your money. So, in case you got lost there, the big picture is interest rates are a price in a market economy, and what they help do is coordinate the saving and consumption decisions of households and individuals with the production activities of the entrepreneurs. And the lower the interest rate, See, this is the problem with Keynesian macroeconomics. They look at the interest rate merely as a brake upon spending. So in their models, when the Fed lowers interest rates, oh, that makes businesses invest more and it makes consumers go spend more. And so, yeah, it might boost C and boost I. But in the Austrian approach, they realize it's not just that businesses go and invest more when interest rates are lower. It's that some types of businesses invest a lot more and other ones not nearly so much. So that's what my point of those examples was, to show the person thinking about building an apartment complex and then renting it out indefinitely is much more sensitive to interest rates than the person thinking about selling hot dogs and lemonade at a golf tournament over a 3-day weekend. And so that's why the lower interest rates messes things up, because it stimulates certain branches of the economy to expand, and then the whole thing is no longer coordinated. And that's why it sets up the inevitable bust. Okay, capital consumption. Rothbard talks about this. So first of all, what is it? It means it's not what this baby's doing. Like, it doesn't mean there are people literally eating capital goods. What it means is failing to invest enough to maintain your existing capital structure. So, you know, you could think of little isolated examples where a farmer who eats the seed corn. Right? So normally, you know, you plant, you harvest the corn. If you want to be able to do it again next year, you have to save some of the seed, you know, some of the corn you have to be saved to be able to replant. And I don't really know anything about farming, so I'm going to stop talking about that. I'll say something silly. Whereas if you ate everything and there was nothing left, then you can't plant, and so now you have no corn next year. So in a sense, your income drops to zero, your real income, your corn income, because you ate the seed corn, you ate the capital, you consumed the capital. A different example, if you're running a fleet of 18-wheelers, you know, you're a shipping company, and you have 100 18-wheelers that are in your company's fleet, on any given day, you probably don't have all 100 on the road delivering cargo. You probably have, whatever, one or two of them that are in the shop getting the wheels rotated and the, you know, brakes checked and the oil changed and all that kind of stuff. And so, and you have to do that to maintain your fleet in good operating condition. Now, if you had a really lucrative order come in, you know, you might temporarily have all 100 of your trucks on the road. You know, if you have this huge client come in that says, oh, I have an emergency, you got to move this stuff from here to this city by Tuesday or I'm dead and I'll pay you. You know, money's not an object. You might say, okay, and postpone the regular maintenance on your trucks to satisfy this customer. But if you kept doing that and just, you know, because you just kept getting orders like that, like, oh, wow, this is great. I'm not going to, you know, and so your truck's no longer getting oil changes and you're not rotating the tires, you're not changing the tires out or whatever, you're not tuning up the engine. I mean, eventually your trucks are going to be on the road and there's going to be a blowout when there otherwise wouldn't have been. There's going to break down on the road because you're not maintaining the engine. So there, in a sense, you would be consuming the capital. Because what happens is it gives you it allows you to enjoy higher consumption than you otherwise would. So with the farmer example, you get to eat more. If you eat the seed corn, you do get to eat more. So that's, you know, there's no denying that your consumption went up. And with the running the trucking fleet, if you have these big customers, then in the short term, yeah, if you're running an extra two trucks, that's more income. But you could see how it's at the expense of the future. So it makes you, so Rothbard points out that this is exacerbated by inflation, because what happens is the inflation brings in new money, and so your customers all of a sudden are spending more, and so you as a business owner feel very wealthy. You see your sales going up. You see the demand for your product going up. And if you don't fully understand that it's driven by inflation, you might get tricked. You might make a mistake. So The way Mises and Rothbard typically explain it is, you're a business owner. So a different example now of what capital consumption can look like. Because the two examples I just said, I think metaphorically are good, but you could say, okay, but what sort of idiot is going to run a trucking fleet and not realize he's got to change the oil? I mean, so yeah, that gets the point across, but that's silly. Who's going to do that? But what's not as obvious and what you could see really could grab people in the real world is, let's say you're running a trucking fleet and you know, even with regular proper maintenance, every 10 years you got to replace a truck. You know, it only has a 10-year lifespan, and then you got to get a brand new one because, you know, that's how hard you run the things, whatever. So out of 100 in your fleet, every year you're buying, well, let's not say that. Let's just say you have one truck. All right, make it easier. You're a small-time operator. You just drive your own rig around, and that's it. And you know after 10 years you're going to have to replace it. And let's say the thing costs $1 million. So out of the income you're earning from shipping products, you know, you get customers who want you to ship something from this city to that city, and they pay you for it. So you're pulling all this money, but you can't spend it all. You're paying for gas, you're paying for oil changes, all that. But even on top of all those expenses, you also every year had better be putting aside $100,000. Now with interest, you know, technically you don't have to put aside that much because it grows with interest, but you get what I'm saying. Every year you got to sock away $100,000 into a sinking fund so that after the 10 years is up, you got $1 million saved up so you can go buy a new truck to replace the one that you just wore out over the last decade. So in that context, the way you would be consuming capital is if you're not putting aside enough so that when the 10 years is up, you can buy a new truck. And the way, so you can see how inflation might make that happen is, if you're thinking it's going to cost me $1 million to replace the truck in 10 years, and meanwhile, you've got all this money coming in, and so you're putting aside $100,000 like you should, and then you're spending the rest because, oh man, this is a great year I'm having. My customers really want me to ship a lot. This is awesome. But then, you know, so after the 10 years, you've saved $1 million. Your truck is now useless. You throw it out. You go to buy a brand new one, and it costs $2 million. And so what happened is you, in effect, consumed half your truck over that decade because the inflation fooled you. You didn't understand. So the thing that's insidious about it is, people's real standard of living does go up during the boom. And this was a point that, like, Tyler Cowen and some other people, I think, were misunderstanding when they were criticizing Austrian business cycle theory a year or so ago. You know, they were saying, well, gee, the Austrians are saying investment goes up because businessmen are fooled. Then how come consumption doesn't go down? And it's because people consume their capital. So that's what makes it physically possible, that everybody truly can feel wealthier during the bubble years or the boom years because they're unwittingly consuming their capital. So their consumption really is higher. Just like, you know, the guy who should be setting aside $200,000 a year, but instead he's going out and consuming it, well, he really is consuming an extra $100,000 a year of goods and services. So you know, he can objectively say, no, I'm not being, you know, this isn't illusory. You know, I read this guy Mises, and he said this is an illusory boom. No, it's not. I actually have a plasma screen TV in my house. I actually went on that cruise to Jamaica. I actually go out and have steak now twice a week instead of once a week. What's he talking about? Because when he's going to realize it is when the decade runs up, and now he's got $1 million and realizes the new truck costs $2 million. And then he's going to say, oh, that was illusory. But he doesn't realize it until then. And then it also explains why the bust is inevitable. And this is really a crucial point, that guys like Krugman say, you know, everyone's saying that, you know, in the comments of my blog, people complain that the bubble years were an illusion. No, they weren't. You know, real output really was that high. But if it was the expense of the underlying capital structure, if the only way we were able to squeeze out so many plasma screen TVs and SUVs and, you know, McMansions and everything was that was by allowing the capital structure to get degraded to a point where now it doesn't matter what we do, real output has to fall 10% for a few years while things recover. Well, then that was capital consumption. And when you think of it in terms of the interlocking structure of physical capital goods, then you see why the bust is inevitable. It's not just, oh, people aren't spending enough. The economy is physically incapable of cranking out consumer goods at the same flow rate as it did from 2003 to 2007. It can't be done because the economy is physically incapable. Just like, you know, with the business owner who wasn't setting aside enough to replace his truck. Well, there it's not as obvious because so he's only got $1 million and the thing costs $2 million. But the problem is the economy, you know, when he was consuming all those years, those resources were not going into what they needed to do in order for him to have that new truck ready. And it's perhaps easier to see it, you know, in the more contrived examples where the farmer eats the seed corn. Clearly, it's not an issue of, oh, well, if we only, you know, gave the farmer some more money so he could go demand more corn. No, he ate the corn, and then there wasn't enough corn to plant. So this year's harvest is lower. There's no two ways about it. I don't care how much money you print. You can't make more corn exist because decisions in the past were made that now have painted us into a corner, and the corn yield this year is lower than it was last year. So consumption of corn has to go down. And or the guy, you know, with the fleet that instead of having two in the shop, doesn't have any in the shop, and then trucks start breaking down. So if you looked at a chart of shipping volume in terms of the physical cargo, you know, how many pound miles he cranked out per week or something, you know, taking 1 pound of cargo 1 mile, and he ran those statistics, he would see, well, gee, during the heady boom period, I was moving a lot more cargo, and now I can't. What's the problem? Well, it's because his trucks are all breaking down because he wasn't maintaining them. So you can see how, if that's your understanding of what the bust is, to say, oh, gee, if we just had the central bank print up more money, that would fix everything. You think, no, man, it doesn't do anything. It just screws everything up even more. Okay, hang on. Let me just jump ahead and see what else I want to talk about. Okay. Okay, government debt. Rothbard makes a bunch of good points here. Is it inflationary? Yes and no. So let me walk you through this. The no part is the easier part. So government borrowing per se is not inflationary in either sense of the term. It doesn't expand the money stock, and it doesn't push up prices. Because when the government borrows money, that act by itself is just like if a private corporation or individual borrows money. It just transfers purchasing power from the lender to the government. So, yeah, if the government runs a deficit and then goes and buys tanks with it, that pushes up the price of tanks. But the person that lent the government the money to do that now has less to spend, and so prices elsewhere fall. Right, so there's no reason the prices in general go up or that the purchasing power of money goes down from government borrowing per se. I mean, you could come up with a contrived story where if the government is borrowing from people who have a high demand to hold cash or something, you know, but you get what I'm saying. It's not the borrowing per se. It doesn't directly cause prices to go up, and it doesn't change the stock of money. Like M1 does not change because of government borrowing directly. However, it would be very naive to just stop there and move on. Because in practice, central banks monetize the debt issued by the central government. So, like for example, in world, you can see in this chart here, this is showing government debt. You can see right here, you see this spike right there? That's World War One. And so the U.S. federal government's outstanding debt went way up during World War One, but also price inflation in the U.S. went way up in World War One, and that was because in order to keep interest rates manageable, the Fed would go into the secondary market and buy up lots of the bonds issued by Uncle Sam to pay for the war. Just like right now, the Federal Reserve, like I'm sure many of you know, the Federal Reserve is now the largest holder of U.S. government debt. So the point is, yeah, technically it's true that the Obama administration running a, whatever their debts are, $1.4 trillion deficit or whatever, that by itself is not inflationary, but I think part of the reason Ben Bernanke engaged in QE1 and QE2 was he knew the federal government was going to run such huge deficits, and they didn't want interest rates going way up. Okay, so that leads to the next point. Suppose the central bank doesn't print more money to buy government bonds. Suppose the government just runs a deficit, spends more than it takes in taxes, and so has to go to the private sector bond markets to raise those funds by issuing IOUs, treasury bonds. If that's the way it happens, then there's what's called crowding out. So other things equal, interest rates are now higher because of the government borrowing, and real resources are transferred from the private sector to the government. And Rothbard makes the point that the difference between the government financing its spending through taxing versus borrowing, or one of the differences, is that when it finances it through a deficit, the funds that it sucks out of the private sector tend to come more heavily from out of savings. Right? So when the government just in general levies a tax to raise money, the households get hit with the tax bill, and then they reallocate, and generally speaking, especially if the tax is going to be constant over time, that's just going to reduce their consumption and their savings. It might change the ratio if the change in their wealth makes them save more or less, but the point is that hit is going to be distributed. In other words, if the household has to pay $1,000 more in taxes, their consumption might fall by $700 and their savings might fall by $300. But if instead the government raises that $1,000 by going to the bond markets, then that $1,000 in the first instance is getting directly sucked out of savings. And then, consumption might fall because interest rates go up, but it's an indirect thing, whereas if it's through taxes, households might spread the burden equally. So, it's not that one's better than the other, but just economically you need to understand that. And then Rothbard says that repudiation really is the only sensible way from a libertarian point of view to deal with government debt. Because how can the government pay off its debt? Only through taxation, which is a coercive intervention in the market. Okay, last thing, Rothbard talks about externalities. We're sort of out of time here, and I don't have too much to add besides you just reading what he wrote. Let me just point out, typically you hear externalities discussed as negative externalities, so like pollution, but they can also be positive in terms of mainstream economics, and they're both cases of market failure. So with a negative externality, the alleged problem with the market is that people are imposing harms on others through their activities, which otherwise might be voluntary, and they're not taking those costs into account. And so factories emitting pollution is the classic example of that. So it's not that the whole enterprise is wrong, it's that on the margin they're producing too much because, the marginal benefits of whatever it is they're making are lower than the total social costs on the margin from what they're producing, because in addition to the labor they're using up and the electricity and whatever for which they're explicitly paying, they're also pumping stuff in the atmosphere and people are getting sick or whatever. So that's the thing you're probably used to, the negative externality. But the positive externality is also an alleged market failure, because there, if someone does something that benefits somebody else and the first person isn't being paid for that, then they're not going to do enough of it. So there, the idea is the marginal benefit of whatever it is they're doing is higher than the marginal cost. And that's a market failure, because that shows if they just did more, then there'd be social gains, right? Because if you do one more unit of it, the marginal benefit exceeds the marginal cost. So you should do one more, but yet they don't, because they just do it to the point at which the private marginal benefit equals the private marginal cost, even though the social marginal benefit is higher than the social marginal cost. All right. So Rothbard deals with, he says, come on. Somebody's smelly socks that are negative externality, right? Because I don't take into account the fact that that bothers people. And so should the government have a tax on me walking around with my smelly socks? That's crazy. And then the positive externalities too, Rothbard saying, look at what we've done here. Now we're criticizing the market because sometimes people do things that other people enjoy. So whether it's, I'm making up these examples, I don't remember the ones he used. So think of it as, somebody who, how every Christmas some households just go crazy and they put up so many ornaments and everything and lights that people might drive for miles around and go, oh, you got to check out this house on Redbird Street. It's crazy. So what house? Just turn left on Redbird Street, go down, you're not going to miss it. You'll know what I'm talking about. And then they, holy cow, I can't believe it, looks like Chevy Chase. And so, but that, I personally love that, those kind of houses. I know where they are near my house, and every Christmas I go and look at them. I don't pay those people money. If they stopped doing it, I would be disappointed, and it probably cost them a lot to do it. It's a lot of effort, and their electricity bill must be huge. And plus, they have to buy all those ornaments and everything, and the lights. But Rothbard's point is, well, so what? I mean, yeah, I guess it's true that if people like me paid on the margin, there might be a few more houses that would do that. That would push them over the edge if they got payment from me. But, that's life. I mean, it's not like we should be hanging our heads, oh, the poor market economy, when people are doing stuff voluntarily that they like doing and that other people derive benefits from. So, there's a lot of other points that Rothbard made, but I'll just wrap that up there. Okay, well, we are out of time, and I have to, my parents are in town for Thanksgiving, so I can't really go over and look at your questions. I will get all caught up with those questions if you posted any new ones on the forum. I'll post the quiz, obviously, and next week we'll have a final exam for those of you who are taking the class for a grade. Thank you again for everybody who was with me for this class, and I'm assuming most of you were here for all three classes. And I hope to see a bunch of you next semester for the theory of money and credit, or if not, maybe some future class. Let me just say, as always, if you have an idea, you want me to teach a class on something, I know some of you have said power and market. I'm open to doing that. It's just with all this stuff, it's a matter of what do we think the demand is going to be. So, if you have any ideas like that, send them to me or Danny or any of the other TAs, and we'll definitely take it into consideration. Okay, thank you everybody, and I'll see you next course.